Welcome to the Federalist Society Practice Group podcast. The following podcast was co-hosted by the Federalist Society's Civil Rights and Criminal Law Practice Groups. It was recorded on Wednesday, March 20th, 2013, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call. Today, we'll be discussing the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals gun rights case and the road forward. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, as is our habit, this call is being recorded for possible use as a podcast in the future. We're going to hear opening remarks from each of our two experts of about 5 to 10 minutes, followed perhaps by a little bit of back and forth, and then questions from the audience. Our first expert, Ken Klukowski, is a national best-selling author, constitutional lawyer, and media contributor, and is on the faculty of Liberty University School of Law. He's been widely published and has authored briefs on constitutional issues across the country. His most recent book is Resurgent: How Constitutional Conservatism Can Save America, published by Simon & Schuster. Adam Winkler is a professor of law, University of California, Los Angeles School of Law, where he's a specialist in American constitutional law. His wide-ranging scholarship has touched upon a diverse array of topics such as the right to vote, corporate free speech rights, campaign finance law, affirmative action, judicial independence, constitutional interpretation, and, of course, the right to bear arms. Professor Winkler also currently serves on the board of directors of the Brennan Center for Justice. Again, we'll hear opening of about 5 to 10 minutes from each, beginning with Professor Klukowski. Ken, please go right ahead with your opening remarks.
Dean, thank you, and thank you to the Federalist Society for hosting this call. Thank you also to Adam for joining us. Adam is a distinguished scholar on the opposite side of the issue for me, so hopefully I'll uphold my end and we'll have a good debate. This is a fascinating next step in the development of the jurisprudence of the Second Amendment. First, of course, we had the Heller case, the first meaningful exploration of the Second Amendment in 2008, which settled a half-century-long debate on whether the Second Amendment was at all an individual right that private citizens hold, or if instead it is a collective quote-unquote right, a power, as it were, of state governments to maintain organized militia units under state governmental control. Of course, in Heller, in a 5-4 decision, Justice Scalia wrote that the Second Amendment is an individual right for private law-abiding citizens unconnected to any type of organized or public militia service. Then in 2 years later, with McDonald v. Chicago, the court took the additional step, again by a 5-4 decision, that the right to keep and bear arms is a fundamental right fully applicable to state and local governments through the 14th Amendment, with four justices led by Justice Alito saying that it was incorporated into the Due Process Clause as part of substantive due process, and Justice Thomas concurring separately saying that he believed it applies to the states through the Privileges or Immunities Clause. Now, both of those cases dealt with the bare-bone facts of a law-abiding citizen in a privately owned residence seeking to have an ordinary common firearm, most specifically a handgun, that was readily usable and accessible in their home for the purpose of self-defense. And really, the limits of the Second Amendment heretofore have been drawn at that line at the Supreme Court level. What's attractive about this case, this is a Moore v. Madigan, which is conjoined with Shepard v. Madigan, two separate cases that were consolidated before the Seventh Circuit. And what's attractive about this case is that Illinois is the only state out of the 50 states that had a blanket prohibition on the carrying of firearms outside the home, unless you're a police officer or some other specialized exempt class, that the general citizenry is not permitted to carry a firearm, a readily usable firearm, under any circumstances whatsoever outside their own home. So in that regard, it reflects the same dynamic of Heller and McDonald. It does not get into the issues of what level of scrutiny applies. Is it strict? Is it intermediate? Might it be one under certain circumstances and the other under other circumstances? Could it be a different form of analysis? Some judges are wondering if we just look to historical analogs without regard to the type of test that we use for example, in free speech jurisprudence and many other fundamental rights. This obviates all that. The Supreme Court made clear that the one standard of review that does not apply, at least not to core exercises of the right, is rational basis review. And in Heller and McDonald, it was made clear that the mere act of possession is in and of itself an exercise of the Second Amendment. Now we get into the second half of the phraseology of the amendment, which Judge Richard Posner picked up in his panel opinion, where he said it would be very awkward to use the phrase keep and bear arms if it doesn't refer to carrying arms outside the home. It's especially important coming, I think, from Posner, because Judge Posner is on record as a very staunch opponent of the idea that the Second Amendment is an individual right. He joined the sentiments of Judge J. Harvey Wilkinson after the Heller Court was decided, characterizing Heller as the new Roe v. Wade, that it was gross judicial activism, that it was subverting the democratic process, overruling the judgments of elected leaders, and declaring a right for individuals that was unwarranted by the text or structure or history of the Constitution. So this is not someone carrying a brief for pro-gun causes, and yet he said that the logic of Heller and McDonald, that the foremost component, the central aspect of the right to keep and bear arms, is a right for law-abiding citizens to be able to protect themselves. That under the logic and the reasoning of those cases, he couldn't make sense as to how that right would end once you're leaving your home. He, in fact, makes the point that he believes you have that you're more likely to need a right to defend yourself walking the street at night than you are behind a locked door in your apartment on the 35th floor of your apartment building in Chicago. So in that regard, this again just becomes a small step forward if in fact it were to be ratified by the Supreme Court. If in fact the Second Amendment does not extend beyond the home, then first of all, it would be sui generis among fundamental rights in the Constitution. There's no other right that we shed as we're leaving the home. Even our Fourth Amendment rights we carry with us in our person and in our cars, et cetera. And instead, this would be a right that perhaps would have very limited application. And in this case does pose the danger of that if the Supreme Court were to take it and were to reverse, to say you have a right to own a gun in your own private home, you have no right to keep and bear arms in any other aspect of your life. Conversely, if it is held to be a right that does extend beyond your home, which I would argue it is, then it really opens the door much wider in terms of additional litigation to start figuring out what type of firearms are we talking about, what type of public places are we talking about, is it just the sidewalk, what about private businesses, parks. Obviously, there are certain sensitive locations that were even referenced previously by the Supreme Court, such as government buildings and public schools. And we'll also, I think, get into a lot of questions then regarding licensing requirements and what hoops or hurdles the government can make you jump through before you can avail yourself of the right to keep and bear arms. So in that regard, it's going to be interesting to see what the court does in this regard. The opinion, which is not surprising coming from Posner, is well written. Whether people agree with the conclusion or not, it's well crafted, well researched, and very thoughtful. En banc, of course, has, for those of you who do not know, the Seventh Circuit, there was a petition for en banc that has been denied with, I believe, four judges dissenting from the denial of en banc with Judge Hamilton, who was President Obama's first nominee to the appellate bench, Judge Hamilton writing the dissent for the dissenters. And now we'll find out whether Attorney General Madigan in Illinois, whether she petitions the Supreme Court for a writ of certiorari.
Thank you very much. Let's hear next from Adam Winkler.
Well, thank you to the Federalist Society and to Ken for joining me on this call. It's always a pleasure to be involved with these teleforums, which are so informative and always engaging. So I think that Ken did a great job summarizing sort of where we are on this case and where we are with the Second Amendment. I want to highlight a couple other things. I want to talk a little bit about how this case highlights the continuing uncertainty about the Second Amendment and its exact scope. I think a little bit about whether this was an unusual case, given the jurisprudence that's emerging, and think a little bit about what's next in terms of how the Supreme Court might step in. So first of all, with regards to the uncertainty question, you know, the Supreme Court in the Heller and McDonald case sort of went out of its way not to provide a crystal clear standard of review for lower courts to apply to the literally hundreds of gun control laws that would be challenged in the wake of the Heller decision. Many people criticized the court at the time. As Ken mentioned, the court made clear that rational basis review would not apply, but didn't really provide much guidance as to what other kinds of standard of review or other kinds of tests, be they historical or categorical or whatnot, that lower courts should apply. So the lower courts have really been searching for trying to figure out the exact best way to approach gun control questions that aren't clearly answered by the Heller or McDonald case. And I think we see that in the Moore versus Madigan case. Judge Posner goes on about how the state failed to meet its requirement of a strong showing of public justification for this underlying law, but never really made crystal clear what exactly the state would have to show to defend its law. This is similar to what we've seen in many other cases that have been decided in the wake of Heller. What most courts have done, but what Moore versus Madigan did not clearly do, is adopt explicitly intermediate scrutiny as the standard to apply to gun regulations. One question that I think the Supreme Court will eventually have to face is, what is the standard of review and how is it going to apply to these various issues? But the standard of review may not be necessary to decide this Moore versus Madigan case in one way. As Ken mentions, one of the big questions that the court has left unanswered is whether the Second Amendment right extends outside of the home or if it's just limited to possession of a firearm in the home for self-defense. As Ken argues, and I think persuasively, the right must extend outside of the home somewhat. The text of the Constitution refers to keep and bear. Bear, the Supreme Court said, as I think it should have, that to bear arms means to carry a firearm outside of your home. You don't really bear arms from one room to another within your house. So there must be some constitutional meaning to that word. And indeed, most courts that have ruled on this, not all, there's been some inconsistency in the lower courts, have recognized that the right may or is likely to be held to extend outside of the home, at least somewhat. But even if it extends outside of the home, how is the scope of the right different given the competing concerns with public safety? A Second Circuit case decided just a little bit before Moore versus Madigan that also dealt with the constitutionality of restrictions on concealed carry held that while the right extends outside of the home, there's a much greater regulatory incentive and need for the government to restrict access to weapons on the public street. But yet, even if the court finds that that's the case and finds that there's a broader scope for government regulation, Illinois is still in trouble because Illinois is the one state in the nation that completely bars people from carrying firearms in any way, with a permit, without a permit, there's no permitting available. And so if the right means anything, it must mean at least some ability to have a gun outside of the home. And so Illinois' law is almost certainly doomed no matter what happens here in this case. Whether they appeal to the Supreme Court if they appeal to the Supreme Court, it seems almost certain that they're going to lose. In some ways, the fact that this case is unusual in some ways and not unusual in others, it's unusual in that what we've seen by the lower courts in the wake of the Heller case is that the vast majority of courts have been eager to uphold challenge gun control laws. In fact, there's been something like 400 federal court decisions on the constitutionality of gun control since the Heller case was decided in 2008. The vast majority of those cases, all but maybe six or seven of them, have upheld the challenge law, and where the law has been struck down, it's usually been an extreme outlier law or a silly law, like the law in Chicago after their handgun ban was struck down, and they adopted a law that said, well, you can have a gun, but you have to have a permit, and to get a permit, you have to do training on a gun range, and by the way, we're going to ban the operation of any gun ranges in the city of Chicago. That one didn't fly in the Seventh Circuit either in a case called Ezell. But on the other hand, what's perhaps not unusual is that where laws have been struck down, there are these extreme outliers. Illinois is an extreme outlier by barring people from having possession of firearms in all circumstances in the public. So maybe this outlier is ripe to be struck down by the Supreme Court. And that raises the question, you know, what's next? Is the Supreme Court going to jump in here? I know a lot of my friends in the pro-gun community have told me that they think that the Supreme Court is going to take one of these cases, either the Second Circuit case, which is known as Kachalski, K-A-C-H-A-L-S-K-Y, versus Westchester, or this Moore versus Madigan case. Because there seems to be a potential circuit split. The Kachalski case upheld New York's restriction of concealed carry licenses to people who can show proper cause, interpreted to mean a special, individualized reason to carry a firearm. But I don't think we quite have the circuit split that they might like. There's enough of a circuit split in that I think in terms of their reasoning and argument, there does seem to be a big difference between Kachalski, which upholds that proper cause requirement, and Moore versus Madigan, which strikes down Illinois' complete ban. But there is a technical difference between these two cases, and it might be enough for the Supreme Court to find there isn't a circuit split here, which is that in Kachalski, there was a permitting requirement. In Illinois, there's no permitting requirement. And it seems that the Illinois legislature could easily respond to the Moore versus Madigan decision by enacting a law, discretionary issue permitting law for concealed carry, and then it would be no longer inconsistent with the law would be no longer inconsistent with Moore versus Madigan, and there wouldn't necessarily be a circuit split. If the court does decide to grant these cases, I think Moore versus Madigan's likely to be upheld. As I've mentioned, the right must have some meaning outside of the home, and Illinois really denies that possibility. But yet, I think maybe some of the people in the gun rights community are a little bit more optimistic than they might should be, but with regards to the permitting requirements and the proper cause requirements. Many people believe that discretionary permitting is unconstitutional. I'll be the first to admit that it's highly problematic. I'm not certain that the Supreme Court would strike it down, however. Not only is there a long history and tradition of heavy restrictions on public possession of firearms. New York first prohibited concealed carry, for instance, in the 1880s, and there have been concealed carry restrictions in the United States since the 18-teens in some states. To the extent that history is a guide to how the court interprets the Second Amendment, it's very possible the court will say that you have a right to carry a firearm in public, but it can be very heavily restricted, as it has been very heavily restricted over the course of much of American history. One of the interesting questions Ken didn't mention, but I think is worth at least a brief note, is whether Illinois will appeal this decision to the Supreme Court. You know, one of the problems that gun control advocates have started to realize is that they keep taking the wrong cases to the Supreme Court. And if you take the wrong case to the Supreme Court, you end up with law that you're not really happy with. That happened in the Heller case. They shouldn't have appealed that case to the Supreme Court, but they did. Gun control advocates have been cursing themselves ever since. Illinois had this law in Ezell that was the subject of the Ezell case that I mentioned earlier, the firing range case. I remember consulting with some of the people in Chicago's government about this law when they were first thinking about it, and I said, "You've got to be kidding me! You can't ban the operation of firing ranges after you've said they're absolutely mandatory to get a permit." Indeed, they pursued that case all the way up to the Seventh Circuit, indeed, even though it was a very silly and almost certainly unconstitutional law. So one question is whether Illinois will appeal this case. It's a loser case, and it could result in bad law for gun control advocates across the nation, and I understand that there is a divide in the Illinois government now between one faction that does not want this case to appeal. They've been advised by Mayors Against Illegal Guns and others, Mayor Michael Bloomberg's gun control advocacy group, not to take this case to the Supreme Court for fear of a bad decision, but there are others in Illinois who are pushing for an appeal, fight to the death sort of attitude. That attitude has not served gun control advocates too well in the past. It'll be interesting to see what they do in this case.
Thank you very much. We do want to get to audience questions. Before we do that, I want to see give Ken Klukowski a chance to respond for a minute or two to what you've said, Adam Winkler. Ken?
Thank you, Dane, and thank you, Adam. Yes, the circuits are now exploring the standards of review. I myself am actually finishing a law review article right now talking about multiple levels that I think could apply on the basis of the burden, drawing analogies with free speech jurisprudence, which the Supreme Court itself has also suggested that. I also agree that without explicitly saying so, Posner's language about a strong showing and that not being shown in this case does suggest intermediate scrutiny. And I would think for a categorical ban like this, not only is rational basis review wrong, but intermediate scrutiny should also be wrong. For that matter, I would argue that a categorical ban shouldn't even be subject to strict scrutiny. A categorical ban on all persons having firearms should be per se invalid. But again, that's an issue yet to be decided by the court. Yes, there have been roughly 400 decisions since then, most of them siding with the gun control laws, and I think it has either been a weak application of strict scrutiny, or it's been an incoherent application of intermediate scrutiny, or they've been very unsavory persons like convicted felons, convicted violent felons, arguing that they still have a right to have a gun, which is a loser in terms of trying to take that argument to a court. I very much prefer this case as a vehicle to go to the court as opposed to Kochalski. I agree that the proper cause stipulation in New York and the whole permitting system, we're getting into a whole new can of worms when we get into permitting. And I know from experience many lawyers who do a lot of work in the Second Amendment don't have much experience in administrative law, and just the whole issue of bringing in that whole body of jurisprudence with licenses and permitting, I think that's an area where the courts are going to be very circumspect in how they advance this law closely, and they would prefer, I think, to lay a firmer foundation in that regard. One point that was not raised by Adam, but that Posner raises and is worth considering, is if you have the right to carry outside the home, that may not be a right to carry concealed. It might be that you have a right to openly carry, but not to carry and conceal it from public view. And Adam correctly notes that there are laws back to the 1800s. There are laws preceding that regarding other types of weapons to the 1700s and before that forbid the carrying of concealed weapons. So that there is a real question as to whether concealed carry is part of the Second Amendment right, or instead if it's a policy judgment that legislatures can make. And finally, I'll say that I believe this case is cert-worthy even without a circuit split. I think taking this case would enable the court to take what is almost a self-evident step, given the reasoning it's already used, and that in doing so, that it would allow the court to flesh out a little more of a foundation that could give greater guidance to the lower courts without having to expressly hold on issues such as the level of scrutiny. And I would imagine if this case were to go, if I had to make a guess, and in a sense only fools do when it comes to the Supreme Court, but I'll go out on a limb on this one, I believe it would be a 5-4 decision. After Heller was decided, there were 4 votes in McDonald, not just to deny that it was a fundamental right, which seems stunning under current fundamental rights jurisprudence. If it's any type of right, it should be fundamental. But those 4 also said they would overrule Heller if given the chance. So I do not regard any of this jurisprudence as settled law for 4 of the justices, and I think only with the current membership of the court would you have a 5-4 a 5-4 vote siding with the pro-gun side in this.
Adam Winkler, do you want to take 60 seconds, or should we go straight to audience questions? Do you want to respond here?
I'm happy to go to audience questions right away.
Okay. All right. Very good. We've got over 100 people on the line, so I think we'll
field quite a few questions here. In a moment, everyone will hear a prompt that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that prompt, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone to indicate that you have a question. So once again, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let me make our usual programming announcement at this point, if you can bear with me. We've got two more telephone calls scheduled, actually one more telephone call scheduled for the remainder of this week. Tomorrow at 2 p.m., our NLRB, National Labor Relations Board, series of telephone conference calls will resume as we look at NLRB's posting regulations. That's tomorrow at 2 p.m. Then next Tuesday and Wednesday, respectively, we'll be having Courthouse Steps editions of Teleforum as our expert attends first the Prop 8 oral argument on Tuesday, and then on Wednesday, the DOMA oral argument and reports to you in a Teleforum conference call. Those are both 1 p.m. next Tuesday and Wednesday. And then next Thursday, we'll be visiting with our expert on the Horn case. That's the case involving raisin growers here in the United States. We've got four callers with questions, so let's see what is on the mind of our callers today.
This is David Applegate in Chicago. Just a few brief comments. First of all, the dissent or the denial of rehearing en banc in the Seventh Circuit was 5-4. With Judge David Hamilton out of Indianapolis writing a dissenting opinion. Second, I'm going to predict for largely internal Illinois political reasons that the Attorney General is not going to try and take this up. I think it's a bad case for them, but more important, I think that both Judge Posner and Judge Hamilton, albeit on different sides of the issue, for legal reasons, are sort of on the same side. And the key sentence in Posner's opinion is that we order our mandate stayed for 180 days to allow the Illinois legislature to craft a new gun law that will impose reasonable restrictions. So I welcome comments from either of the speakers based on the vast number of reasonable restrictions that Posner hinted at and that David Hamilton laid out explicitly in his dissent from the denial to rehear it en banc as to what you think reasonable restrictions might be.
Who wants to take that one first? Professor Winkler, you want to respond?
Sure, happy to do that first. Well, I think that I don't know that there's much to read into the statement that there are reasonable restrictions that the government can make. I think it is part of the history and tradition of the right to bear arms that there are reasonable restrictions on access to guns. You know, we often think of gun control as a modern 20th century invention, but really nothing could be further from the truth. The founding fathers had gun regulations when they wrote the Second Amendment, barring large portions of the population from possessing firearms if they were not deemed trustworthy, had restrictions on how you could store gunpowder, and of course had pretty vigorous militia laws imposing special burdens on gun owners to come out and serve and even have their weapons inspected and registered on public rolls. This pertains especially with regards to public possession of firearms. Southern states started enacting bans on concealed carry of firearms back in the early 1800s. Many people find it surprising, but the South was the originator of many of today's kinds of gun control laws. And they weren't about keeping blacks from having firearms, even though that's what we might assume given the South. They were slave states after all. But the states weren't, but the slaves weren't allowed to own guns at all. These were laws that were designed, the restrictions on concealed carry at least, were designed to restrict access to guns in public by law-abiding white people who were sometimes too eager to draw their guns to defend their honor and whatnot. And of course, we had concealed carry restrictions throughout the 19th century, and we've had them throughout the 20th century. It's really only over the last 30 years that we've seen state after state make their laws more permissive and allow virtually anyone who doesn't have a criminal record and who is of age and without mental illness to carry a gun in public. So there's that long history and tradition of restrictions, and I think that that's part and parcel of the Second Amendment and its Second Amendment right. See what happens with Illinois. There are others on the call who probably know more about Illinois state politics than I do. What I've been hearing is that there's very little chance, if not zero chance, of a discretionary permitting law being enacted for concealed carry, that political powers that be in Illinois are sufficiently strong in favor of gun rights that it's likely to be a shall-issue permitting system or no permitting system whatsoever, and literally have a system where anyone could carry their guns on the street without even requiring a permit, which is the law in a handful of other states currently. So I don't know that we'd read too much into it. Obviously, the meaningfulness of this case in the long run may have more to do with those reasonable restrictions than with Illinois' complete ban. We all sort of agree, if you believe the Second Amendment protects the right of individuals to have guns for personal protection, as I do, then you have to recognize there's some right to carry firearms in public, and clearly, this law does not allow it. It'd be interesting to see if the Supreme Court wants to take this case, though. I think that, right now the mood of the country has definitely swung towards a little bit more towards the gun control side of the spectrum in the wake of Newtown. And I wouldn't be surprised to see, just as the other institutions in Washington, the White House and Congress, have taken up gun control as a big issue again, I wouldn't be surprised to see the court avoid it for those same reasons, because there's a lot of raw nerves on this issue. Of course, if the Supreme Court were to take it, it wouldn't be till next term, and so maybe things would be died down a little bit by then.
Yeah, I think I'd add 2 points to that, and I'll take them in reverse order. The first would be that I would imagine that, as Adam said, it would be the preterm conference at the end of September is where the court would end up voting on whether to take this case. I think the mood is shifting quickly enough. Just this week, it became clear that Senate Democrats would not be including an assault weapons ban in any proposed litigation, and Senator Dianne Feinstein is having a fit about that publicly. That I think, and you want to be careful. You don't want to be compared of acting like a sixth grader. But in that regard, I wouldn't be surprised if, given all of the gun control laws that are now being contemplated at the state and federal level, if the court might not think that the mood was at least right to take in briefing and consider setting forth additional guidance that could impact the intermediate courts in terms of as they consider this new raft of laws that are coming, again, mainly at the state level. So I do think it'll have been 4 years since there's been a decision on the Second Amendment, and I think that it might be time for that. Now, in terms of what types of restrictions are reasonable, there are 9 justices on the court, and 4 of them, I think, will categorically say any proposed restriction is reasonable because they're willing to allow anything up to a complete banning of all firearms. Among the 5 that hold that it is some type of individual right, I would hazard the guess that each of them probably draws the line in a different place. And I don't think we have any sense right now as to how broadly or narrowly a majority of the court is reading that. I think a number of restrictions get into more problematic areas. For example, if you have a domestic, if you have a restraining order issued against you in the course of a messy divorce, that can make it illegal for you to have a firearm. There's no other fundamental right in the Constitution where not even having been convicted of a misdemeanor, to say nothing of a felony, that you're just going through a divorce with no crime having been committed and that both sides stipulate to that, that you could still lose all right right to possess a firearm, the Lautenberg Amendment from the 1990s. Something of that nature might be looked at. It's Heller and McDonald, especially Heller, had some unhelpful dicta. You get language about presumptively lawful restrictions. Well, of course, that can be used as an argument that neither strict nor intermediate scrutiny should apply, and obviously that would just leave rational basis review, which the court later makes clear is not the standard for core exercises of the Second Amendment. So in that regard, the dicta seems to be facing in the opposite direction of part of the court's holding. Other language regarding unusual and dangerous firearms, well, of course, all weapons by definition are dangerous. So what are we talking about unusually dangerous? And so how are we going to reconcile all these things with concepts of due process, trying to achieve the twin goals of making sure that law-abiding citizens trying to own what are common firearms as they go about their daily business, that there are broad and robust protections to be able to do that, while also, just as a matter of realpolitik, and insofar as that will be reflected in the law, looking at dangerous individuals or especially dicey situations and figuring out a framework which would make it clear that there are some burdens that do not violate the Second Amendment right.
Very good. If you'd like to join our conversation today, we're talking with Adam Winkler and Ken Klukowski on gun rights. You'll need to push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to our next caller.
Hi, this is Nelson Lund from George Mason Law School. In light of the proposals that have come up in Congress recently, I wonder if the speakers could say something about the divided opinion in the D.C. Circuit on the validity of bans on so-called assault weapons and high-capacity magazines.
I'm happy to take that question. Always happy to take – this is Adam Winkler, by the way. Always happy to take a question from Nelson Lund. No one has taught all of us who study the Second Amendment more about its meaning and how it applies in our current society than Nelson Lund and his terrific scholarship that he's done over there at George Mason. And so hats off to Nelson, and glad to hear that you're on the call. I tend to think that the Supreme Court is unlikely to strike down any of the major gun control proposals that are currently being considered in Washington. That's not to say there's not some arguments against them, but I think the D.C. Circuit, a case that Nelson asked us about, which is the Heller 2 case, Heller against District of Columbia, which was a challenge that Dick Heller, who was the Heller behind the original Heller case that went to the Supreme Court, brought a challenge to a variety of new Washington, D.C. gun restrictions, including restriction on access to high-capacity magazines for firearms and restrictions on assault weapons. The D.C. Circuit, and I think it was an interesting outcome. Perhaps the feature of, or the proposal that's the most subject to constitutional challenge of those being considered in Washington, D.C. today would be a ban on assault weapons. I think this law is unlikely to pass, so we're not likely to get a Supreme Court ruling on it in any case, but I think it's the most subject to constitutional challenge. The Supreme Court in the Heller case said that the arms that are protected by the Second Amendment are those that are in common use for lawful purposes, like self-defense and otherwise. These firearms clearly seem to be in common use, although I imagine there's some debate we could have about that. There are millions of these firearms out there and available, so it does seem like they are in common use. They tend to be used for lawful purposes. Indeed, their use in criminal activity is extremely small. Only a fraction of gun deaths every year are at the hands of any kind of rifle, and only a fraction of a fraction from a so-called assault rifle. But that said, there's this D.C. Circuit Court opinion that was not appealed to the Supreme Court and will not be appealed to the Supreme Court, from what I understand, where three judges ruled on the constitutionality of Washington, D.C.'s assault weapons ban. I should say that they only ruled on the constitutionality of the assault weapons ban as applied to assault rifles, not necessarily other kinds of firearms. Court's decision, written by Douglas Ginsburg, so certainly no lefty liberal who loves the big state and big government nanny state, wrote a decision upholding the restriction on high-capacity magazines and assault rifles. And the argument that he made in that case is interesting. He said, yes, these firearms and the magazines are likely to be in common use because there are so many of them out there in circulation. However, he said, well, when, that tells us that they may be protected by the Second Amendment, but then applying a kind of intermediate scrutiny, the court said, does a restriction on access to these weapons substantially burden anyone's right of self-defense? And he said, no, these restrictions on these weapons don't substantially burden anyone's right of self-defense. There's a whole bunch of other kinds of firearms you can have access to. Those of those people on the call who follow the assault weapons ban know that the big problem with these bans is that they're completely riddled with loopholes. Basically, it's whatever you don't like or whatever someone doesn't like about assault weapons, you're allowed to sell that weapon nonetheless, so long as it doesn't have a pistol grip. And so, really, when push comes to shove, the ban on assault weapons is more like a ban on pistol grip rifles than it is a ban on any particular kind of lethal weapon. And as a result, oddly enough, then restricting access to this kind of weapon, which doesn't really restrict your access to semi-automatic firearms or semi-automatic rifles in general, doesn't actually burden anyone's right of self-defense very significantly. And the court said with regards to high-capacity magazines that this was also not a serious restriction on anyone's ability to use self-defense, that the vast majority of self-defense incidents don't involve anyone shooting the gun at all. And those that do involve shooting the firearm only involve shooting the firearm very infrequently and not more than 10 rounds. And indeed, the court was willing to buy, in that case, the police's argument that anyone who's shooting 10 rounds in a self-defense situation is likely to be doing more harm than good at some point. So I do think it sort of suggests that larger reluctance on the part of courts to second-guess gun control laws, even in the wake of Heller, and even if the judges are Republican appointees who are known to be on the libertarian side of the spectrum.
If I could add to that, first I'll start by joining Adam and saying that I'm glad Nelson is here, and there's perhaps no more insightful or impactful scholar on the Second Amendment. And I've written in one of my law review articles that I joined several others that I think it was the green brief that Kennedy referenced in oral argument, the one submitted by Nelson that won over Kennedy in a fifth vote in the case. But setting that aside, this D.C. Circuit case, Heller 2, was an odd split. You had Judge Kavanaugh in dissent, but Brett Kavanaugh saying that he was applying just a historical analog, that he thought the court was saying they were not to apply any of the usual standards of review, strict or intermediate. Everyone acknowledged it was not rational basis review, even though I appreciate a great many of Judge Ginsburg's opinions. I found this one really lacking. It seemed to be far more deferential, an intermediate scrutiny that was not really heightened at all, that seemed to give a great deal of deference to government authority on this. Is it important public interest, public safety? Do we want to make sure people aren't getting randomly shot? Well, yes, that's important. Is this substantially related to it? Yes. Well, then this is constitutional. Under that sort of reasoning, there's a great many of restrictions. It's intermediate scrutiny that doesn't really seem intermediate, to say nothing of strict, and I would wonder which standard of review should apply here. The problem with something like an assault weapons ban is that most of the restrictions, most not all, are indeed just cosmetic. And Adam referred to, for example, pistol grips. That's the most common one, a standard grip on a rifle versus a pistol grip. The 1994 prohibition forbid you to have two military features on the firearm. One was okay, but if you had two of a list of features, suddenly the gun became evil. And one of those features was a bayonet lug. Not a bayonet itself on the end of the barrel, but a lug upon which a bayonet could be affixed. So these all seem to share the characteristic of making the gun look more scary, but it did not make it deadlier. It did not make it more impactful. And indeed, there's been some great things shown that, for example, a .30-06 rifle is far more powerful than Bushmaster 223. And yet no one's talking about banning a .30-06, which is far more deadly, more accurate with a longer barrel, and it has a longer deadly range, the reach of its bullets. But nonetheless, it just doesn't look as scary as a fully decked out Bushmaster does. And yes, these are in common use. There are 4 million of these supposed assault weapons out there. And assault weapons isn't even a real term of art in the firearms industry. It is a made-up term. There is no class of firearms called an assault weapon. There are assault rifles, but not all assault rifles are covered under the assault weapons ban, and many of the so-called assault weapons are not rifles at all. Some of them, for example, are shotguns. And so it looks to be a term that's just made up in terms of politics, and I think that's a lousy basis upon which to make law. There were additional claims in the lower court in Heller that I would have liked to have seen gone up. For example, there was a handgun where if it was a handgun with a polymer grip, that was on a list of approved firearms by the city. The district has established a list of okay firearms. But if you had that exact same model with a wooden grip as opposed to a polymer grip, suddenly it was illegal. Now I think on grounds like that, you could say that you could challenge the restriction for being arbitrary and capricious. That sort of restriction might not even pass rational basis review. Now, in terms of, again, the point was made at the end that often the showing of a firearm is in and of itself a deterrent. Well, that actually then cuts against the idea of an assault weapons ban premised largely on cosmetic features, because the whole reason they're being targeted by certain politicians is that they look more scary. And if they're scarier to look at, one would assume they would have a greater deterrent upon the person looking at it who might become the recipient of the business end of that firearm. So it's, I think that gets it right into the thick of kind of where the fight is going to go. On restrictions on magazines greater than 10 rounds, some are saying greater than 15. I don't know where the court would draw the line on that, and I think that sort of line drawing would be fraught with peril, but I'm not confident the majority of the court would agree with me on that. The only one I've seen that I think might not survive constitutional challenge would be the one recently enacted by New York State, which is limiting firearms, handguns, to 7 rounds. 95% of handguns take more than 7 rounds. Unless you have what's called a single stack magazine, for those of you who are not familiar with firearms, unless you're talking about a single stack mag, which is typically on a low profile pistol, most other ones hold more than 7 rounds. So I think a provision like the one that is now the law in New York, the one they had to amend because it didn't even exempt police officers and all of a sudden they would all be in violation of the law, that I think a restriction like that outlaws 95% of what are unquestionably common firearms, that may cross the line. But that's exactly into the weeds that I think we're going to be heading into after one or two clearer cases like Moore would be, I think, if it were to go up.
All right, just to give you some information here, we have 5 callers with questions. We've got about 12 minutes left, so I think we're going to have to move through these as quickly as possible, try and get to as many questions as possible. We appreciate your patience. Let's go to our next caller.
Hi, this is Jeffrey Morrell from Marquette Law School. Thank you both for doing this. My question is sort of something you guys have both been speaking to, which is in Heller we saw this common use language, and then the Posner decision out of Illinois seems to look like intermediate scrutiny, the D.C. Circuit decision intermediate scrutiny. Moving forward, I think we can all agree we're going to be seeing more challenges to gun laws through the courts. Do you think that some articulable basis, some kind of insistence on one standard review or over another will prevail, or what kind of review might that be?
Well, this is Adam Winkler. I think we've already seen it emerge. We have seen circuit after circuit after circuit over the last 2 years move towards intermediate scrutiny. where they have a two-prong test. They say, does this law burden something that's within the scope of the Second Amendment? If it does not, the inquiry is over and the law is upheld. If it does, then the court asks the second question, is the law, does it substantially further the government's important governmental interests? That's what we're seeing in case after case. I think it's very unlikely we'll ever get strict scrutiny. Remember, we've had gun control laws being debated at the state level long before the Second Amendment was reinvigorated in the Heller case, and none of the 50 states applied strict scrutiny to gun regulations under their state constitutions. So I think strict scrutiny is unlikely to come about, and intermediate scrutiny almost certain to be the standard that's applied over time.
Hi, Jeffrey. This is Ken. A couple things to that. First of all, that points against some of the problematic dicta that we have in the Heller decision. And again, for example, the reference to longstanding prohibitions. Well, the prohibition regarding from the Lautenberg Amendment, I believe that was 1996. The assault weapons ban from the Clinton years was 1994. How long does a prohibition have to be on the books before it's longstanding? And does that mean if something is unconstitutional, but we enact it and it goes long enough, a sufficient number of years before it's challenged, that suddenly it becomes sacrosanct? So that certainly would be at odds with the remainder of our jurisprudence. Some wonder if this kind of dicta had to be included in order to get to five votes on the court. Of course, I have no idea if that's true, but if it is true, it certainly points to the idea that there might be very significant restrictions that the court's current membership would be willing to uphold. I hope intermediate scrutiny does not become the generic standard. I agree that we've seen it in a number of courts, but I think that's just a deeply flawed approach. I think it makes much more sense, and again, I have a vested interest because I have a law review article coming out on this, but this is why I wrote the law review article, is I think there's so many analogs to be made with free speech, that most fundamental rights are only exercised by people if they run afoul of the law, but that there's roughly 90 million gun owners in this country. So just like free speech, it's something that a great many Americans do on a regular basis. And I think we need to look more to the idea of just is this within the scope of the right, but as we do with free speech, does this go to the core of the right, or is it more of an incidental burden? And in that regard, I think you have strict scrutiny, you can have intermediate scrutiny. Some things can be per se invalid, where not even strict scrutiny is sufficient. Certainly, if you were to have, as you had in New Orleans and Hurricane Katrina, where law enforcement ordered that all firearms citywide were going to be seized by police, and that was done until a federal judge issued a TRO, but thousands of firearms were confiscated in the interim. Many of those have never come back. That would arguably even satisfy strict scrutiny, that we are having an absolute emergency. There is a breakdown in not just social services, but even in social order, and that law enforcement requires extraordinary latitude in order to try and preserve that order. That's an argument that might even satisfy for strict scrutiny, especially if you promise you're going to give the guns back as soon as the situation is stabilized. So I think depending on the nature of the burden, we could look at one of several different things, especially since the core of the Second Amendment, it's not nice to talk about this in polite company, but the core of the Second Amendment is not just self-defense against private criminals, it's also the public's collective self-defense against a potentially tyrannical government one day. And that anti-tyranny rationale, I think, raises special flags regarding the limits to which the government can then disarm the population. And we do see it happen in situations like Katrina, which are extraordinary circumstances.
Four questions left. We're going to try and get through all of these. Actually, three now. Somebody just logged off. Try and be as direct as possible, if you could, with your questions. Let's go to the next caller.
David Emerson here in Berkeley. The Illinois law refers to a ban on carrying weapons in public. I'd like to get the speaker's reaction to a couple of other laws which seem to be, in practice, actually have a broader scope. One is the Gun-Free School Zone Act, which even as amended contains a provision prohibiting the carrying of guns within firearms within 1,000 feet of schools, public or private. And in a densely populated urban area, that is effectively a complete prohibition on carrying weapons. And also here in California's recently enacted California ban on carrying handguns loaded or unloaded in public.
I'll just respond very quickly. I think the Gun-Free School Zones Act, there's a lot to be said on that, not just as a matter of individual liberty, but also as enumerated powers. If we go back to Lopez, instead I'll just take the brief time I have regarding the handgun ban. I think that could well end up, and again, I'm not overly familiar with that law, but if it is as you describe, then I would imagine it should suffer the same fate that the Illinois ban would have, that it's that handguns were the focal point of both Heller and McDonald. So a categorical banning of the carrying of handguns outside the home, it is certainly more likely, given the court's rationale for why handguns are useful for self-defense in Heller, it would certainly be more likely if you're carrying a firearm in public for self-defense that you would be carrying a handgun on your hip than that you would be carrying a shotgun or a rifle slung over your shoulder. So under a consistent application of the Moore rationale, that would not survive. Of course, if this is the Ninth Circuit, it would all depend on the judges you draw.
Adam Winkler, anything on this point?
No.
Okay, let's go to our next caller.
Hello, sirs. My question is regarding language. You mentioned earlier that we're afraid to mention the tyranny argument, for instance. To those of us that support the Second Amendment, it seems like our main argument has been personal rights, just a simple, unbacked up personal right to own a firearm. Do you believe there's language that isn't being exhausted about self-defense, about gun control not working against hardened criminals, about fighting back in tyranny, as according to John Locke? Do you believe there are other arguments that should be exhausted?
My own view is that this is Adam. I think that what's been exhausted is the tyranny argument, which really finds, I think, a lot of difficulty in fitting within our understanding of individual rights and the text of the Second Amendment. The text itself of the Second Amendment provides that a well-regulated militia, being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. The framers knew what a well-regulated militia was, and they recognized that it was generally government authorities that were regulating the militia. And indeed, the Articles portion, the structural portion of the Constitution, provides that Congress has the power to arm and discipline and call out the militia. So the idea that you have an ability to take up arms against the government, I think it's true that the Founding Fathers were revolutionaries, and they thought that ultimately people would take up arms against the government, and having a civilian population helped ensure that that was possible. But I don't think that really explains the Second Amendment and why we have the Second Amendment, and certainly doesn't can only be realized if we ignore the language in the Constitution that calls for a regulated militia and that calls for Congress to authorizes Congress to organize and discipline and arm and presumably train and impose other kinds of requirements on that militia.
This is Ken. I'll add to that. That actually invokes a lot of the reasoning that was underlying the collective rights model of the Second Amendment, that it didn't apply to private citizens at all. That was almost verbatim what came from many of the briefs on the other side of the case in Heller, arguments that the court was rejected. Under the laws of the early republic and in Title 10 of USC now, there are two classes of militia: organized, which is uniformed and under state control, and the unorganized militia, with certain exceptions, is basically all able-bodied adult males having the ability to bear arms. And in the Heller opinion, Scalia expressly says that a concern about government tyranny was what led to the codification of the Second Amendment. The core of the right might be self-defense, but it was concern as a safeguard against a tyrannical regime that led to the amendment's codification. I think the best single explanation I've seen, because we don't have time here, would be to look at Judge Alex Kaczynski's dissent from the denial of en banc in Silvera v. Lockyer. That was 2003, where he, I think, lays out well what the rationale is in that regard.
Well, gentlemen, with apologies to our final caller with a question, I'm afraid we're going to have to cut this discussion short. We're just simply out of time or running out of time. I do want to thank Ken Klukowski and Adam Winkler both for joining us on our call today. We'll obviously invite you back depending on the next steps here as this case or other cases move forward. To our audience, again, I invite you to join us for our next Teleforum conference call. That's tomorrow at 2 p.m. Eastern Time at this same number, when we'll be discussing the National Labor Relations Board posting regulation. But until then, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.